Blog Talk Radio.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, immaculate.
Now listen to this.
Dr. Mark, and this is Soma Time. Number to call to Wine and Opine is, 646-478-4847. That's 646-478-4847. Wow, where do I begin? Here we are in October 21st. It's been a long month, my friends. Yes, very long month. Lots of things going down. Lots of things coming across the wires. And, we've reached that point. We've gone through a couple of phases of this implementation of the vaccine that's supposed to free us from the scourge of the swine flu, the swine friend, as we call it here for our purposes. But we've got a couple of weeks left here in October to sort things out, get through Halloween. And as we enter November, I got to think of a name for that, because I think this flu season is going to be on, going on until the spring, the way we're having it here. So, without further ado, as we take a peek up at the NLCS here, the Philadelphia Filthies are beating the Dodgerinos there 4-2. It's been a home run fest so far. Nauseating. Next week we'll be dealing with Game 1 of the World Series. Between the two teams I hate the most. So I'm not going to be a happy camper on Wednesday night next week. I hate that phrase, happy camper. Ooh, I just skeeved myself. Anyway, let's go check out a little swine friend news before our guest comes on here and tries to soothe our weary nerves. There was something I noticed before. I know there's been so much going on, between the healthcare debate and all that stuff, I just got to boil this thing down to, what are we really dealing with here? I mean, it's been, almost every other day there's somebody out there just going back and forth and back and forth about the seasonal flu. Actually, Obama did get his seasonal flu shot today, is what they said, joining his family members. But here it is, the Cleveland Browns. All right, so here we go. This is great. Not bad enough they got to deal with Man Genius over there. But let's just play my new swine friend introduction. I'll give you a little news when we get to our interview. There we go.
Oh, son of a bitch, a gun. You thought I was going to say son of a bitch, didn't you?
That's right. Here we are, H1N1. Bartender. The Cleveland Browns have been sacked by the flu. Coach Eric Mangini said 12 players, including Pro Bowl nose tackle Sean Rogers and 5 other starters, are home with flu-like symptoms as he plans to adjust his practice schedule on Wednesday and the team prepares to face the Green Bay Packers this weekend. Wisconsin, hello, number one in H1N1 cases, right? Mangini's taking precautions to make sure his players get more rest. They haven't been tested for the swine friend yet. We're trying, at the first signs of any kind of illness, to get the guys home and out of the building. Even the trainer's sick. I mean, it's a mess. And you're going to see more of this. You know, all these teams travel, hockey teams, all that stuff. And here's a rule from Commissioner Goodell, a memo that was sent out on October 2nd. If a club has at least six players unable to participate as the result of confirmed or suspected cases of swine flu, it can receive roster exemptions and promote players from its practice squad. A club can receive a maximum of eight exemptions. There must be medically confirmed cases of swine flu. So the seasonal flu, screw you. Swine, we've got to pass. This procedure does not apply to any other type of flu or illness. See? So well, they're in on it, too. The NFL is in on the swine thing. It's amazing. There was a guy on the Houston Texans that was, I think he was officially diagnosed as having the swine flu, but what's the difference? Anyway, looks like our guest is here a little early, so we'll jump from that. We'll get back to that later because there's so much to say about this, and maybe we can get into this a little bit, our guest. I don't know. So I think we're going to go over there now, and let's see. We'll get and once again, for those tuning in late, I'll give you the rules of life according to Elvis Presley before we kick off.
Two things you need to know. Uh-huh. I'm the king, and number two is look out, man.
That's right. Okay, so joining us now from an undisclosed location in California is Dr. Beverly Potter. I will lower the breathe. Leave the doc again there, and welcome to Soma Space. Summertime. Sorry, I'm from Soma Space. Dr. Potter, you there?
Yes, I am. I'm here indeed. I was just trying to figure out what those strange noises were.
Oh, there's a lot of strange noise on this show. Sometimes they even call in. So I don't know if the hysteria of H1N1 has, you know, perpetrated the skies out west, but out east there is a almost a daily sort of fire drill about this thing. You know, they've really done a good job of kind of keeping the public with their head on a swivel. So from where you sit, has the swine flu been something that's been on the radar in your travels?
Well, definitely people are talking about it. That's not something I've been paying too much attention to.
Okay. Because, you know, your kind of field work is deals with people experiencing career burnout, which a lot of times will be accompanied by people having illnesses like this where their body will succumb and break down over time. So the physiological side of what you do is really where I kind of want to start.
Okay.
You know, if anyone's just saddled up on the air here, talking with Dr. Beverly Potter, her book deals specifically with worry warts and how we've sort of taken something that's part of our survival skills and made it into somewhat of a cultural ethos in a way. Worry has become a way of life for a lot of us, especially in the last year or so, as the boat has gotten crowded. So to kind of get started here, when someone is worried about something specifically, instead of a general kind of like, you know, just I always had that image of Piglet, you know, just kind of standing there riddled with, you know, just fretting. Is this something that is going to touch certain personality types, or is it going to touch people basically because of situations? Or how does someone get into a state of worry that they can't get out of?
When a person gets into a state of worry that they can't get out of, that's what we call worry warding, or obsessing, sometimes we call that. And what happens is they get into rut thinking or a thinking loop where they think about the situation, whatever it is, usually in extreme words that they're telling themselves and images. And when they get to the end of thinking about it, they start thinking about it again, like a loop, over and over and over. And as they do this, it is generating anxiety, and then anxiety triggers worry. So it becomes this vicious cycle that just gets worse and worse. And as the person becomes more anxious, they find more and more things to worry about, what you were calling fretting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
or
we call
obsessing,
it in
worry warding.
Yeah, in somatics, it's affectionately known as the dreaded fretitis, because it's inflammation, chronic inflammation due to worrying is the physiological side of it, because the body will become sort of hypervigilant and overly sensitive to its environment because it's spooked by it. And what happens with worrying a lot from the bottom-up standpoint, I know you're dealing more with the cognitive top-down angle of it, is that the breathing rhythm goes off, their proprioception, their ability to perceive themselves in space gets a little wonkish, and they don't move so well because, you know, it's lions and tigers and bears out there. And so this whole process, I mean, I know in the last 10 or 15 years they've kind of pried open the brain a lot and tried to find the circuit. There's a lot of literature out there, the worry circuit, which touches on things like OCD and other behaviors. Have you been more interested in the social aspect of worry, or more the biology of it as it's become more pervasive in the culture?
Well, I wouldn't say either one.
Oh, all right. So which way do you
well,
go?
Well, let's just get back to the hypervigilance. Worrywart, one of the characteristics of a worrywart, if you wanted to come up with, you know, the personality of a worrywart, one of them is that they do tend to be hypervigilant. But the fact of the matter is that we are all hypervigilant. We just don't realize it. So just try to imagine that as a metaphor, deep somewhere in the recesses of your emotional brain, you have this little eye. And the eye is constantly watching or being vigilant, even when we're sleeping, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And this eye is watching all the time because actually, as a physical being, we're really quite vulnerable. We don't have claws. We don't have thick fur, long teeth. You know, we just have this skin. We can get cold. We can get punctured. So we're very vulnerable. And this eye is like all the time watching, and it's saying, am I safe? Is everything okay? Is everything all right? Am I safe? So when it starts picking up on those things that you're saying, the bottom up, the breathing getting off, or slight signs of tension or whatever, that as we're going along, we're not really noticing this, but this little eye picks up on that and goes, uh-oh, wait a minute, something's wrong. And as soon as it starts imagining, and we're talking metaphorically here, as soon as it starts imagining or seeing something's wrong, then it looks for a reason, a cause for that problem, that wrongness, that sense of tension. And that it just pulls out of the drawer worry to worry about. Then you're off to the races, because then you're worrying about the worry that is generating more anxiety. The more anxiety is finding more things to worry about, but nothing is getting solved. The person is just riling themselves up, and some people continue to do this to the point of a panic attack. The people can even go to the hospital in an ambulance thinking they're having a heart attack, and they're having a panic attack.
And how this behavior, again, because it's part of survival, it seems like there's an involuntary sort of default setting to protect the individual,
exactly.
But then it becomes pervasive and overprotects them and can somewhat isolate them in their own little, like you say, this kind of menage of physical noise in their system and this sort of confusion in the mind of I'm not safe, which gets into a developmental thing that we study in somatics called neuroception, which if you listen to the program on a regular basis, that first year of your life when you're sort of bonding with mommy, this is the sort of the homing pigeon of, am I safe? Am I safe? Can I find a friendly face? And a lot of times when you see people that are worrying, they seem to seek outside support much more readily than they seem to seek inside support. So it's hard, like...
Well, that's part of the problem. They don't know. They are not supporting themselves. They are riling themselves up.
Right, and then they turn to somebody
else.
And
you can't sort of be doing both at the same time. You can't be supporting yourself and riling yourself up simultaneously.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of the problem of a worrywart. The other side, see, we're only talking about one end of the continuum. There's this other thing that I'm calling smart worry, or worrying smart.
Okay, well, let's make it
the same. Because the idea is not to get rid of worry.
Right, you can't.
The idea is, well, and we don't want to because worry is good. Worry is identifying a potential problem, coming up with a plan, and then we're prepared. Then we're safer. But the worry wart doesn't come up with a plan. They just make things worse by riling themselves up into a state of panic in some cases. What
so
a smart
let's
worrier
get a little
does.
Zen with this first.
I beg your pardon.
Let's get a little zen with this first. If we're worrying in a good coherent fashion, we're in an active state of contemplation. We're planning. We're getting extremely logical. We see things progressing from beginning to end. Like if we're going to make ourselves a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, you know, the worry part is just the trigger that. I have an intent. Do I have the ingredients here? You go through that mental kind of like checklist, and then you build your sandwich. But if during the process of doing that, you know, you drop the knife on the floor, something upsets you, you kind of lose that awareness, and now your system says, well, I don't feel safe. And instead of being able to recover that list that gets you back on track, you're sort of wandering around in your head, and like you're saying, the system becomes disoriented and it can't communicate well to itself. So if worry is inevitable, because we have to sort of kind of carve out our future, to use this knife analogy, how do we get to the point where we can sort of transition from the survival aspects of it, which bring us down to a kind of a root level, to more of the higher levels, the abstract levels, where we actually get good information about the future that we can act on?
It's a learning process. It's a set
okay.
of skills. It's
so
a bunch of set of skills. Hold on. Now, we could think of the body as a biochemical robot,
okay.
a very sophisticated biochemical robot, and we somehow are this spirit or soul or whatever it is that is occupying this robot like a driver in a car. The problem here is that nobody bothered to give us a manual on how to run this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't, so we can learn how to run it or we can run it poorly. And the worry ward is running it poorly and doesn't know how to run it. And they're like driving in a circle or something. So what I'm talking about as being worrying smart, or you can use those other phrases of the higher, I can't remember what they are exactly, but is a matter of learning a set of skills. There are thinking skills of how to think through a problem creatively rather than just thinking the same words over and over. There's what I'm calling talking to yourself as a good friend would. What the worry wart does is talk to them, because what worry actually is us talking to ourselves. It's either words or images in our minds that are frightening us and making us scared. So worry warts talk to themselves in a way that triggers, I call it fuddy-duddy, FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. They talk in a way that triggers fear, uncertainty, and doubt. But a good friend, it's sort of like the devil on one shoulder and the angel on the other shoulder whispering in your ear. Well, this is the fuddy-duddy on one shoulder and the good friend on the other shoulder. The good friend talks to you in a much more balanced way, more objective. You can say, so when you catch yourself worry-warding, first you have to recognize that you're doing it. When you catch yourself doing it, you can stop yourself and say, wait a minute, what would a good friend say? What would Mark say to me about this right now? Well, and even sort of role play to themselves what their good friend would say, which they may say something like, hey, wait a minute, did you ever look at it this way? Or, come on, give yourself a break. Or, look, let's talk about that later. Let's watch this show right now or something. Okay, we can, and part of what worry is with this robot that I'm talking about that's so sophisticated, run by this incredibly sophisticated computer, it's also very simple and has certain things about it that is really incredibly simple. For example, it can only think one thing at a time, and at least with this words or the chatter or whatever you want to call it. Another thing is that whatever you're saying to yourself or imagining in your mind, the body responds to as if it's real. Well, these two principles are very important because part of dealing with worry is to not try to stop it. You cannot tell a worrywart to stop worrying. They won't stop. They'll worry more. Hmm. Instead, you crowd the worry out. Instead of saying that set of words, which are causing fuddy-duddy, fear, uncertainty, and doubt, and anxiety, you say a different set of words, which are the way a good friend would talk to you. And this is a skill that one can get better and better at. Another thing is that worrywarts picture, they catastrophize. They go to the worst-case scenario immediately, and then the body responds as if all that is going on. Well, you can deliberately think other images, catch yourself, say, wait a minute, and instead say, well, what would be a positive possibility here instead of the terrible disaster that I'm telling myself could happen? So there's a set of skills of learning how to, quote, worry smart, meaning worry the problem through, come up with a plan, like your peanut butter and jelly sandwich. So now you know what you're going to do, because so worry is really like a mental fire drill.
Right.
We all know that a fire is possible, so we have fire drills like in school and so forth. Then if there really is a fire, everybody knows exactly what to do. You have a plan, you're much more likely to get out, and there's less confusion and so forth. Well, it's the same thing with worrying smart. You worry the problem through, you now have your plan, but the problem is that when worrying triggers anxiety, anxiety triggers worry, and there's this propensity for a vicious cycle. So when you're finished worrying the problem through, you need to do the second half, which is soothe yourself to bring yourself back to balance. And that's what worrywarts don't do. They don't soothe themselves. They rile themselves up. So
suppose it's behavioral. I'm just trying to understand this from my side of the coin here, which is more getting out of your head and getting into the felt sense awareness of this. If worry is a learned behavior in terms of being able to worry smarter.
Thinking is a learned behavior. Thinking is a behavior.
Okay. So then if we're dealing with this, if you don't acquire these skill sets, worry left to its own devices – is like ivy on the walls. If you don't learn how to get out of it and, as you say, become a smart worrier, is it the default setting that you become a worrywart, that if you don't learn
well,
these skills,
no,
you're
everybody's learning something. It's not like you either learn how to worry smart or somehow you're on default. No, a person has learned a bunch of bad behaviors.
Uh-huh.
You know, their mother or their grandmother or their brother or somebody was a worrywart that riled themselves up constantly and made themselves crazy and everybody else and was sick with anxiety, et cetera, et cetera. And they learned to do it too. We always have skill sets. It's just, are they helpful or are they tripping us up? So we need to relearn skills and get better and better at it. It's not either or. It's a matter of getting better and better all the time at it. But part of it is learning how to think the problem through and all of that. The second part is taking deliberate action, sort of like taking yourself in hand and saying, well, you know, I've taken care of that problem. I know what I'm going to do. But now I'm in a state of anxiety, so I need to deliberately soothe myself. Now, people who are have a high emotional intelligence, there's a list of qualities, and one of the qualities is that the emotionally intelligent person knows how to soothe themselves. That's why I started calling it smart worry.
Mm.
So some of the techniques for soothing oneself are dovetail right into the kinds of things you're talking about. I mean, meditation, for example, a lot of people find prayer to be very helpful with worry. And if we look at what prayer is, besides the spiritual, metaphysical aspects, prayer is you saying a whole bunch of words, thinking a bunch of thoughts that happen to be soothing. And instead of thinking the worry thoughts, you crowd them out with the prayer or the mantra or the affirmations. We could call all of those things prayers.
Mm-hmm. I guess.
But that would only be one method of soothing yourself, you see. People can, you know, everybody's different. And there's lots of different, you can soothe yourself with drinking certain kind of teas.
Right.
Or meditating. Not everybody wants to sit and meditate, you know, or taking yourself and putting your body into a nice warm bath.
Yeah, there's a lot of soothing. Like, this is the aspect of it I'm trying to get at, because if it is a behavioral thing that's reinforced by these things, as you're saying here, I'm looking at worry from the standpoint of how do we get integration here? Because if it's completely focused on the future, if worry is always a future-paced state where we're looking at our future, we're not feeling, like you said, the FUD thing, there's fear about the future, there's uncertainty about the future, and I'll just call it dread.
Right. Mm-hmm. Fear, uncertainty, and doubt is just good because it spells the word FUD.
I'm just dread down.
Or dread.
Exactly.
I mean, dread, that definitely triggers anxiety.
Now, a lot of that could be coming in from things from the past coming into the future. So how do we deal with...
We're not necessarily saying it's only future. In the past, we can be worrying about the past. A lot of times we just call it something else, guilt. But it's a similar kind of thing. It's just we all know.
Why it's a circle, then, is what you're saying, is that because the person is not able to take action on those feelings or be able to distance themselves from those thoughts, they sort of live in a vicious circle of either the memory that they don't want to re-experience or the prospect of having something coming at them from the future that they're trying to avoid. So, it seems like it's rooted in sort of that fight-or-flight, avoid behavior, resist.
Well, that's what it triggers. You know? This kind of thinking, this negative thinking triggers that fight-flight because of the, you know, that's the way that the robot works, the hard wiring.
Mm-hmm.
Fight flight is hardwired. What triggers it?
And you think most of this is coming in from the outside in, where people get socially conditioned into living this way? And
well,
that, at a certain
I mean,
point they rely
certainly there's
on
probably.
Or...
It's not just all outside in. I'm sure there's variations in our biology. Some people are maybe more sensitive than others.
Mm-hmm.
But,
yeah, there's a certain design to this. Is this related to thinking styles as well, where someone who's a kinesthetic learner who learns through their body as opposed to someone who talks to themselves or looks at pictures would be more likely to fall into this state, since it is a negative kinesthetic type of a process where the body feels unsafe, so the mind has to go through machinations to get away? And it just seems like it's much more more of a gut thing or more of an internal thing than... And you could think yourself into it, like you said before, but it just seems like there's a lot of chutes and ladders here.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're the wise men looking at the elephant, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are all different ways to this biochemical robot with this incredible central processor that resembles a computer, with us, the soul or spirit in there, is pretty complicated. And so all of these kinds of things are just different lenses, but we can use these lenses to gain control to know what to do. We don't just magically know how to operate this robot, this vehicle that we're in.
And if you're giving someone just sort of a 5-point checklist of am I a worrywart or not, what would be the questions you'd ask them?
Of whether or not they're a worrywart?
Yeah, they just want to sit there.
Well, they know whether they're a worrywart or not.
Well, they probably already know. But
well, what are some of the characteristics? Some of the characteristics of worrywarting are certain kinds of emotional anxiety, worrying about what I should do, what people think, catastrophic thinking, going to picturing extremes, obsessive thinking, where you're just going around and around, being very judgmental of yourself and other people. All of these are characteristics of worrywarting.
And do you find that this is something that's situational, or is this something that becomes part of their personality? This becomes part of their coping mechanisms over time, or are there only certain contexts where they'll be
both.
Okay.
Because there's certain situations that are going to be trigger more worry, and some less, but. The person is still, you know, it's a matter of how they're thinking about things. We're constantly thinking at all times. We're never not thinking, even when we're sleeping, we're thinking.
So let's
and it's a matter of what are we thinking about?
Well, let's take a look at some practical applications here. Something you call underreacting. If we're looking at and relating it to the culture a little bit, on a daily basis, before you even get in the car to go to work, or even sometimes during your commute, you're given 8, 10, 15 messages that are alarming, that are upsetting, that are downright just frightening sometimes about the state of the world, whether it's your local news giving you who was raped, murdered, pillaged, or beaten in the last 24 hours, or if we're looking at the healthcare crisis, or if we're looking at this swine flu. You know, it just seems like there's a constant waterfall of trauma, drama, karma going on, and you would prescribe people to take sort of a news fast.
One thing a person can do is just cut out the news.
Mm-hmm.
I used to say, for myself personally, I spent years where I was just not in contact with news. I didn't look at newspapers. I didn't look at television. I mean, you know, no news. I mean, I'd hear a radio, but I didn't listen to any news. And I used to say anything of import, I'm going to hear about in 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So when 9/11 happened, how long do you suppose it took me to hear about it?
On the West Coast, I mean, a lot of people...
Well, anyway, it was instantaneous.
Sure.
You know, so one way to be proactive in your life is potentially to cut out the news. Or another thing is reduce the amount of, or even eliminate caffeine.
Mm-hmm.
Because caffeine, we all know, is a stimulant, and we can be stimulated without really being aware of it. But this little eye, remember the eye? See, stimulation, anxiety, really sort of for the robot, same thing. Little eye picks up on that stimulation, goes, wait a minute, I'm anxious, what's the problem? And so that stimulation can start, for some people, triggering the worry-wart cycle.
Now, do people go through worry-wart withdrawal as they disengage? Because it would seem like, just like trying to you're taking a behavior, as you're saying, as a survival thing, and they're suddenly cutting off the flow of information, because a lot of people will lean on the Today Show and lean on these things as sort of comfort food to surround themselves in that environment. So even though it's not the most empowering place to be, it's familiar. And I always say people will choose known misery over unknown misery almost every single time. So in the process of disengaging from these things, what can people look for as sort of, you know, signs that they're getting out of the dark forest, that they no longer crave the news? Or they no
well,
longer crave
it's
the caffeine?
Well, it's different
or...
for each person. We're not saying everybody's going to cut off the news. It's
right.
Like a smorgasbord of different things that one can do to soothe yourself. The point is, you've worried through your problem. Now you have to take yourself in hand and soothe yourself. So so one thing a person can do, rather than watching the news, which is going to probably rile you up, because the news is filled with all of these disasters and frightening things and negative stuff, don't watch that. Instead, watch an animal show, right? Or watch a romantic comedy.
And do you think
see, anything humorous changes our mood, and it releases anxiety.
Yeah, there's a whole new deal with that as far as using the movies as therapy, cinema therapy, that taps into these sort of background emotions that sometimes people aren't even willing to talk about, you know, in a professional therapy situation, that they don't want to get in touch with it. So they'll turn to media like that, like you're saying,
mm-hmm.
as a source of grounding for themselves, and it doesn't matter. Sometimes they'll watch, you know, the tearjerkers, and they'll watch the romantic comedies, like you're saying. I still look at that as a half step to being able to reclaim your first person authority when it comes to worry, because I look at that, all those things, fear, anxiety, things you're talking about here, as sort of aspects of that person's lack of a sense of coherence to get them back to being in harmony with their environment. So when you talk about underreacting,
underreacting is where people are talking to themselves, self-talk, thinking, whatever you want to call it, all the time. The mind is going all the time. And if it's not words, then it's images, but it's usually words. And the way in which, and people who tend to be explosive or worry-warding, getting, you know, this anxiety going, emotions going, they tend to talk to themselves in overreactive ways. What if, Chicken Little said, what if the sky falls is an overreactive thing to say. What if, oh, this could happen, that could happen. An underreactive statement would be, so what if? Even if we say these things without even any content, we can sense the different emotional response to the phrase. So instead of, this is a disaster, immediately the body responds as if it's in an emergency, because the brain and the mind has just told it that. An underreactive statement would say, would be, this is no big deal, or I can handle this. One of my favorite underreactive statements, the underreactive is one of the techniques that I like. One of my favorite is, it's only money. I mean, it sounds absurd, but way back in ancient history when, you know, like when I was a college student, and I'd get some huge bill, like my car broke down or something, and it would be like, oh, no, and I'd be distressed and upset, and what am I going to do? It didn't manifest any money doing all that. Now I say, it's only money. The end of the phrase is, it's not my arm.
Okay.
Well, I actually, about 2 years ago, I fell off a ladder and ripped off my finger.
Really?
And every time I say that, like right now, as soon as I can feel the missing finger. And that reminds me, and I go, it's only money. I mean, it's not my finger, you know?
Yeah, okay. So you can actually use past trauma as sort of an anchor to say, you know, if you've had, you know, something tragic happen in your life or something. Because there's a certain amount of inevitability with worry that almost sort of like kind of defaults us. I hate to say that word, defaults us, but it kind of pushes us towards experiences that we tend to not want to have, but we have anyway. People pass away. People move in and out of our lives.
Well, yeah, you know, what they say, shit happens, or maybe you can't say that word. But,
yeah,
you know,
you
things
fired,
happen.
Yeah.
Life is filled with problems, with tragedies, with mistakes, you know, all of these things. Learning to be a smart worrier or Pollyanna doesn't get rid of these things.
Right.
I mean,
so
maybe we call them
denial
or something, but it's how do we cope with them? Well, some people cope with them by worrying. Some people feel like somehow they're protecting. A lot of times there'll be one worry ward in a family, and they sort of magically imagine that by their worrying, which is this thing that they're stuck in, but they like it, they're clinging to it, even though it upsets them, they sort of believe that their worrying is protecting the family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or there's this story about the two women. The one woman was waving her arms around, and the second woman said, you know, what are you doing, waving your arms around? And the first woman said, well, it keeps the tigers away. The second woman said, there's no tigers around here. The first woman said, you see? It's working. So there's something about worry that it can take on this kind of magical aspect. As long as I keep worrying, the bad thing won't happen.
Again, this is one of those things that, and you've been doing this long enough to see the cycles of the way it goes through the media. When back in the 70s and 80s, it was the era of positive thinking, and everybody was out there with their books, waving their arms. And in the 80s and early 90s, it got into a little bit of the neuroscience realm, and it got a little bit more internalized. And now you've seen it gone full circle, where it's gone into the spiritual realm, and you see people talking about, you know, the generalized mode of a lot of the stuff, which would fall under the rubric, which I should hit something here, of the law of attraction, where people with the more they think in these eddies, as you're talking about, they seem to attract the negative event rather than, you're saying, the war of the tigers, they seem to put themselves in a parallel situation, or they put themselves in a victimhood, and they'll take a neutral experience and interpret it negatively and then worry that it's going to happen again. So how do you deal with people that are waving their secret book at you and saying, you know, I'm practicing this law of attraction thing, and I'm sitting here with my vision board, and I got, you know, and I'm not taking any action. I'm completely internal, and I'm just expecting the universe to just kind of change the sheets and just give me a whole shower of abundance here. And the phrase in that community is that you're either not applying the principle enough or you're not applying it correctly. So if someone is a worrywart who's worrying, if they're not applying the law of attraction properly, don't these things...
Well, those people in the law of attraction, they use it to sort of browbeat the worrywart, as if just do this and your worries will go away.
Right, they're trying to antidote it. And, you know, like you're saying, that this becomes... exacerbates. It's almost like telling, you know, someone to calm down when they're upset.
Going to calm down. If you tell them calm down, they won't. They'll just get more upset, because by telling them to calm down, you know, they cling to the upset. You can do something else to soothe them, but ordering them to calm down almost never works. Same thing with the worry wart. You say, oh, calm, don't worry, stop worrying. They will just cling to that worry.
So a lot of these systems, whether it's faith or whether it's more of a, you know, sort of a push-button kind of a mentality, they seem to lead to dead ends. I'm just trying to think this through with you here. If someone has been to the point where worry has taken over the way that they function, if someone's listening and they're going through a period of career burnout like you deal with, and they're sort of rebuilding their life from you know, reinventing their life on the fly, And they've made these mistakes, and they know they have these grooves in their nervous system where, you know, certain things set them off. What's the first step that they can take to sort of, you know, put themselves on level ground so that they're not going to repeat these mistakes going forward? Or they just have to accept that they might?
They have to accept that they will.
They will. It's inevitable.
I mean, you don't just flip a switch and have all of your habits for the last 35 years dissolve away because you decided you were going to get grounded.
Well,
you know,
fact,
I mean, any kind of change, regardless, is incremental. It's hard. We all know that developing a new habit or getting rid of an old habit is not just a matter of flipping a switch. And any time a person, whatever the change is, they're going to backslide. That's just the way it works. And so the important thing is to realize you're going to backslide, anticipate the backslide, and have a plan for bouncing back from it.
So if recovery involves relapse, whether you're dealing with...
It's always going to involve relapse.
When you're in relapse... And you know you're there when you've, quote-unquote, fallen off the worry wagon here.
Yeah.
Is it something that you have to learn how to be able to be self-sufficient in that context? Or do you become much more of a seeker of smart worriers and surround yourself with people that have achieved this skill set, as you're saying, rather than rely on the circle that dragged them down in the first place? Because a lot of people will lean on their family, lean on their partners, lean on their social circle, as they're going through any type of recovery. And sometimes those are the very same people, kind of like we're doing with the stimulus package with the government, and that's like a little tangent here. Do they need to become much more socially open and be able to be receptive to new people who have different ideas, different experiences with this situation in order to give themselves other brains to bounce things off of rather than relying on themselves exclusively? Again, we're going to deal with a spectrum here, but I'm looking at it much more as, since it is a social phenomenon, since it is something that everyone experiences, when someone's coming out of that awareness and they're saying, okay, I really want to work on this issue. It's ruining my life. I can't get anything done. I can't let go, because a lot of times you're dealing with control issues as well, and especially when you're dealing with, like you said before, the family fretter who's worried about everybody else but doesn't take care of themselves and then breaks down. When someone's coming through that, is it much more important to be sort of in, almost like when you first go to school and you make friends again, you walk around with a name tag on and sort of go through the process of introducing yourself to others, or do you go in your head and try and play it out in the back
well,
of the garage?
Well, see, you love either ors. Is it this or this? Or is it
well,
it's all of the above. It's all of the above.
Well, Okay, but that gives people too much of a menu.
We're talking about thinking. We're thinking all the time. All the time. I wouldn't put worry into this class that you're describing. I put alcoholism or smoking or some other habit. But worry is we're worrying all the time. It's not like flipping a switch and now we're not worrying. We're worrying or thinking all the time. And it's a matter of learning how to think in a different way. And we have to keep catching ourselves and then reinstructing ourselves to think in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't put it into this model that you're describing. So I can't answer the question.
That's okay. As they say in parts of Arizona, no worries. So they say that in Australia, I guess.
It's the Aussies. They always say no worries.
I was thinking of Cinco Dados, the community in Arizona. I'm familiar with anyway.
Yeah, Aussies there too.
I think so. Yeah. So going forward, like looking at this as something that, let's just focus on some context here. If you're dealing with health, it's relationship to worry over time. If someone is prone to the worry ward, I'll call it the generalized worry ward syndrome, all these behaviors you're describing, what's the impact on their health short term?
Oh, it can have a terrible impact on their health. For one thing, they are in the alarm state of fight flight constantly. So their body is being jacked up constantly, and all the physiology that goes on when you're in the flight state to take off to protect yourself, and this has a tremendous impact upon health and can be triggering all kinds of short-term and long-term disorders and diseases from the various hormones. I mean, I'm not an MD.
Right. Well, we're just taking us from one context to the other here.
On that level, on the health, then, not getting enough sleep. Well, when you don't get enough sleep, that has a terrible impact on your health and your thinking. You can't even think straight. So the being in a constant state of arousal, alarm, fight, flight, whatever you want to call it, is a form of severe stress, and that is not good. That is bad for the body. That's why the smart worrier first worries through the problem and then takes deliberate action to soothe themselves to turn off this anxiety.
And again, you're saying this is a learned behavior. They have to go through it just like riding a bike. You got to fall and get up and keep doing it. And so you think the support system is out there for smart worrying, or this is like an esoteric...
There's a support system. I mean, people call up their friends and when they are worried about something. And their friend, I mean, we can always think very calmly about somebody else's worries.
Again, okay, so this is what I'm saying.
Discuss their issues with them and so on. That's a good thing to do, is to reach out to other people and that helps you think it through to look at it a different way, because the worry ward is stuck in this unproductive loop.
And you think the accountability comes through action. When someone continues to worry about something, and maybe they're repeating this to their friends all the time, I'm really worried about what's going to happen next month, da, 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 da. And every time the friend hears this information, they can sympathize, empathize, or even somewhat, try to, disassemble it for them. But if the person doesn't take action, and 2 days later they're back doing the same stuff, really worries, doesn't work out, it seems to wear people out. They get the cauliflower ear.
Well, then
that may be part of it.
Then they, that's another cost of worry. They're driving their friends away.
Right. So okay,
they're making themselves sick. They can't sleep. They're driving their friends away. Many of the problems with being a worry wart.
And it becomes like you're saying, the more these circumstances sort of get added into the mix of the core behavior of being a worry wart, the less help and support they're going to get from their social circle, because people are going to look to avoid them because it's draining to be around them. So they become more socially isolated, more desperate, like the drowning man. They keep pulling people in. So if we're looking at it from a career standpoint, because this is the context you work in the corporate world, how do people deal with career worry as opposed to personal worry, and what's the resources for
well,
them?
There really is.
Situation?
I mean, worry is worry. It doesn't really matter. The two blend in, and whether it's career worry or personal worry, there's
isn't
really
it just a job?
I beg your pardon?
I say, isn't it just a job? Like, isn't it just money? I mean, a lot of times, like I said, that disassociation line that you said before, when people are invested in their career, 8, 10, 15 years, and their career has hit a standstill or they're in a burnout situation, if the kickstand for that is to separate the identity that they have in that job from their personal identity and to be able to put that into context.
I wouldn't suggest doing that at all.
Okay.
I mean, we're talking about the worry watch companion, but burnout worry is a component, a process that goes on in burnout. But burnout is a destruction of motivation, and it's caused by feelings of helplessness, damned if you do, damned if you don't. And it's very severe, and in the absolute extreme, it can actually kill people. Learned helplessness
is the core cause of burnout. Burnout is way worse than worry in terms of
they're not the same thing. They're apples and oranges. Okay,
well, they're both fruit.
Worry can aggravate, exasperate burnout. But burnout is a huge process that is the destruction of motivation. Eventually, the person just can't even work. They might want to, but they just can't follow through. There's something wrong with their motivation. It's caused by feelings of powerlessness and helplessness. That's just one of the most severe things that you can do to a person is make them powerless and helpless.
Isn't that akin to when someone's in a state of worry?
No, apples and oranges. It's totally different. Being in a state of helplessness is not the same thing as worrying. Worrying is thinking, and it could be thinking negative, positive. It could be productive, unproductive. Worry could help create a state of helplessness, but worry is not helplessness.
Well, I think we're dealing with basically the cake and the ingredients here. If worry is the ingredient that creates this fruition of your calling burnout,
I didn't say that worrying creates burnout.
Well, bad worrying, not smart worrying. I mean, worry warding, I guess.
No.
You're not going to connect the dots here. I'm going to.
You can connect them all you want. You're making
well, I'm gonna,
up the, you're saying these things that.
Well,
I'm not agreeing with them. Okay?
Oh, no, I'm not saying you are. I'm saying this is my position on it because we have a disagreement. I'm going to go down that well for a minute. If you're saying that this is a state-regulated thing, worry is a state-regulated.
No, worry is not a state. Worry is
right.
A certain kind of thinking. Worry is thinking.
Right. And
burnout is something else entirely. Thinking is a component of burnout.
Okay.
Make their burnout worse because of the way they're thinking about it. But burnout and worry are not the same thing.
Well, why don't we define burnout then so we understand the difference?
Burnout is a destruction of motivation. It is a process by which a person who is motivated, the way they get themselves moving, they get up, they move around, they do things, and all that's involved with motivation becomes damaged and destroyed, and in the worst case, they won't get up at all. They won't move. In the very extreme case, they die. For example, taking a very simple example, you have dogs. They're totally naive dogs. They're paired with all the kinds of controls for an experiment. You take the first dog of the first set, and you put it in a situation in a room, and there's a grid floor and a lever.
Okay.
And you put the dog in there, and the electricity is off, and the dog is in the room, and it's a happy, naive dog. What does it do? It walks around, it wiggles its tail, it sniffs. It's a happy dog. You turn on the power under its paws, and what does the dog do? Well, it tries to get off of the floor, but it's in the room. and it can't get out. So it's trying to pick up its paws. It starts running around. It starts freaking out, growling, barking, maybe, you know, scratching, whatever. And in all of this racing around, it hits the lever. When it hits the lever, the power goes off. Dogs are pretty smart. This dog is no longer naive. You put it back in that room, it recognizes that room. You turn on the power, it might race around once or twice, but pretty soon, very quickly, that dog, maybe in one trial, will learn to hit that lever. That dog has learned that it can control its world. It can, it's bad, but it can do something. It can hit the lever. And that dog is motivated. It's screwed up, it's neurotic, but it's a motivated dog. You take the sister dog or the brother dog paired, you put it in the same exact situation, only there's no lever. And it puts the dog in there, it runs around, it's a happy dog, turn on the power, the dog freaks out, starts running around, scratching, clawing. It goes through a process of going through what we could call anger, that might be growling, and then it starts sliding into depression, despair, and death. That's the process. Well, pretty soon, that dog running around, there's no lever. There's nothing it can do. It runs around, can't do anything. Pretty soon, the dog lies down on that grid floor and takes it. Now, you take that dog, the first dog learned very quickly, run over there and hit the lever. You take that dog that now has learned that it is helpless, and it lies on the grid floor and takes the shock. It won't even try to get away. Now you put it in the first, it won't even try. It can't find the lever. You stand there, you put it in there, and you have the door wide open. You go, come on. Won't even get up. It is no longer motivated. And there's been, you can't even do this research on human beings because it's so devastating. But we can find examples where people have died, and we can come up, we can look around the world and we can say, okay, why do couples who have been married 50 years, one dies and the next one dies 2 months later? Could be learned helplessness. There's a whole huge body of research called learned helplessness,
right?
Done by a guy named Seligman, and then he moved into the opposite, into optimism. Well, my model of burnout is that burnout is not caused by stress, it's not caused by thinking. Burnout is learned helplessness. That's the dynamic, and it is caused by feelings of powerlessness and helplessness, and when a living being realizes it's powerless and helpless, it gives up and dies. That's what the research shows. That can be promoted, that can be exasperated by the way we think. It can be aggravated and propelled by worrying. A person can think themselves into helplessness, but it's two different things. So
okay.
That's what burnout is, and it's very hard to turn around. It's not like, you can just, and that's one of the bad things, because people can look at the person and go, well, why don't you just get grounded, or why don't you just, No, it's an extremely detrimental process that kills. It destroys the spirit.
So you'd be creating a comparison that people do a lot with depression, where they see somebody's depressed and they think, oh, come on, just cheer up. And
right.
The person is clinically depressed and they literally can't cheer up.
They can't cheer up.
Right.
And then trying to get them out of it. I mean, of course, they tend to use psychiatric drugs to get people out of it.
Yeah.
But, it is possible to stop, as long as it's not totally, except that being depressed changes the chemistry of the body. So it also becomes self-propelling. But it is possible for people to get themselves out of depression, but it is extremely difficult. And you could say that burnout is like job depression. Burnout is really a kind of depression. A person who is really depressed is not motivated, and they can get worse and worse, where they could literally die. They just give up and die.
And again, this happens a lot to people in midlife, dealing with biochemical changes that are running on parallel tracks. And they sort of feed off of that. And I just think the culture, like I said, because we're so label conscious of the way we look at these conditions, rather than dealing with them systemically, we try to deal with them through the diagnostic channels, which are sort of filtered. And you said, like you said before, that they seem to turn to the meds, as the kickstands for these
things.
Well,
yeah, I mean, they're using meds for everything. I mean, defining things that aren't...
Shyness.
Shyness. Well, you know, I mean, all of these things are a continuum.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's shy, you know.
Right.
When do we get to the point where we need meds? Everybody worries, but when do we get to the point where it becomes, you know, and this is something I rebel against. And that, and with the little Worrywart's companion book, by the way, somebody pushed me into writing this book. I've written lots and lots of books.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody pushed me into writing this book. I thought, oh, how boring, how horrible. It was a person who was a publisher and extreme Worrywart. And I thought, oh. You know, because what are we going to talk about? Desensitization, relaxation, all the books on worry, they're all filled with psychobabble, which I loathe. They make the person who is the worry ward or whatever it is that they're talking about like this sick person. And it's all psychiatric, and it's all, and I just loathe that. This little book has none of that. I mean, maybe it's in... embedded, but there's none of that. It's very friendly, and my objective is a lot of these things, they make it worse. Mine is to bring the person back to, you know, normal, copable life.
And what percentage of people do you think are out there are smart worriers? Is this a new behavior?
Oh, who knows? But, I mean, it's a continuum. Everybody, you know, it's not either or. It's a matter of becoming, A, understanding, oh, grokking it. Oh, I see. What I really need to do is think more problem solving about this and do X, Y, Z, and then I'll be able to deal with this better. I mean, anybody who pays attention to and says the worry ward is because they're being bothered by this worry. They can't sleep. They're staying up all night, way awake.
And the cascade of this is from what I'm getting out of you here is that since worry is a decentralizing behavior, as you're kind of articulating to me, as people become much more fragmented in their thinking, and they can't become cohesive in their actions. It becomes sort of a chaotic rhythm here where they can't stabilize, and the drugs, which will numb them to that, sort of disassociate them from that fragmented thinking. So the worldview might be the same, but the experience is muted, and that creates more discontinuity. So it seems like it just complicates the matters. It doesn't really give them anything empowering, except it's sort of like if they're watching the Weather Channel, it's a hurricane, they just mute the TV. They're still looking at a hurricane in there. So practically,
but a lot of times people, I mean, I'm drugs to me are one of the last options rather than
the first option for most
because
of us.
Part of the problem, once you start taking the drugs, it's easy to, without even realizing it, to start thinking that you need the drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And then you do start needing the drugs, you know, when the people get into the, especially with the depression where they, or the sleeping problems or whatever, where they got to take the drug to go to sleep and then they got to take the drug to wake up.
Right. And again, this is the sort of the side effect of the side effect, so to speak, is that people become so reliant on outside-in methods. Especially when it comes to post-traumatic stress, this is one of the biggest areas that I've worked with in the somatic world, is that injury and illness create a record in the system, and the person becomes extremely aversive to going back into that memory. And so when someone's dealing with a loss or someone's dealing with anything that could be looked at as being traumatic to them or threaten their identity, worry becomes the first thing that pops up because they're trying to escape. They're trying to go around something that the obstacles on the course, and to sort of remind them that the obstacles in the course are not to be separated. They come as a match set. If it's inevitable we worry, if it's inevitable we're going to relapse as we recover, and if it's inevitable that as we go through these experiences over time that there's a learning curve, how do you get people to accept this when there's so much indigestible experience? It's not going to be great. Like you said before, this is not going to be a pleasant thing most of the time to work yourself through. And people are much more interested in avoiding pain, avoiding suffering, avoiding anything that sometimes avoiding thinking.
Avoidance of pain. I mean, that's hardwired into the robot.
Right, so that's almost part of fighting
the key,
their own design.
That's all part of the key that keeps that starts generating many of these negative vicious cycles. For example, back to the woman waving her arms around.
Yeah.
And we know there's really no tigers there. Well, all right. So let's break this down. There's a state of anxiety which can be very, very subtle. The woman waves her arms, all right? So there's this state of anxiety. She does something, waving her arms. And then what happens is that there is even a momentary relief in that anxiety, okay, which is the avoidance of pain, which is what we're highly motivated to avoid pain. Anything that we can do to avoid pain, even if it's just a little bit, is reinforcing. It's called negative reinforcement, meaning reinforcement by taking pain away. Now, people think negative reinforcement means punishment. That's incorrect. Reinforcement is anything that makes something more likely, namely waving the arms around again and again and again, and that's propelled by this momentary reduction in pain. You have a headache, that's painful. You take an aspirin, the pain goes away. What are you going to do next time? Well, then you add on to that an addictive substance, like you have anxiety or depression, something, and you have the drink, which is the alcohol. It takes the pain away, it soothes you, but it's also physically addictive as well as mentally. And that's how you, with this negative getting rid of pain, gets us into these vicious cycles. They're like addictions.
Yeah,
and we become trapped in them.
And it just seems, like I said, we've become so label conscious in the culture that a simple thing, like we just talked about before, with dealing with the gradations of the grayscale of depression, where mild depression comes and goes, and then you have moderate depression, which leads to some withdrawal behaviors, then you have chronic depression, which leads to what you're saying before. These are autoimmune conditions and become, you know, rapidly degenerating as people go through the sort of fishing for the right, you know, chemical stew to kind of stave off the suicidal thoughts and all the other, and the self-destructive behaviors. So just kind of go.
Sometimes when a person is depressed, and then, you know, we're talking about really extremes here, and now they've decided they're going to commit suicide, and they actually start feeling better. Why?
Because now they're
in control. They got a plan. I'm going to do this.
Yeah, so I guess...
Thinking about suicide, you see, starts becoming reinforcing because they think, I'm going to get out of here, I'm going to have control, won't they be sorry, or whatever the dynamic is, it becomes self-propelling because that made them feel a little bit better for a few seconds. So what do? They think about it more. But the problem is we don't understand how this works. I mean, it works all over the place. It works with, there's the man, go back to the work situation, the manager and the employee. Well, if productivity goes down and the manager stomps in and chews everybody out, people will, you know, they'll sit there in their desks, they'll look busy, they'll work harder, and that's reinforcing to the manager. But then they fall off again, so the manager becomes a punisher.
Right, exactly.
And this dynamic gets going. And so this is part of the dilemma of the human existence, I suppose, because the positive cycle, which is what we want, the negative punitive cycle is almost instantaneous. And that's what's so reinforcing to the punisher, is that you get that immediate response. And to get the behavior you want through a positive method takes a long time, so it's less reinforcing. And that is, and whether it's with ourselves or with other people, and that's part of the dilemma.
And again, just to kind of draw some parallels, because in the last year with dealing with the recession, a lot of worry has been basically kind of socially, you know, kind of, I want to say, precipitating through the culture, and people have that maybe have never really had to experience this, maybe have been immune to it for a certain period of time, are now in contact with other people who are placing them in this on the outskirts of town here. And again, just to to kind of go back into this burnout model, the one I learned a long time ago was the three-component model. Christina...
Mashlack.
Yeah, okay, yeah, and I guess Jackson was involved in that research and going back about 20, 30 years maybe at this point. But it was a three-component model: emotional exhaustion, depersonalization, and this sense of, like you said before, this sort of give up, diminished personal accomplishment, the kind of that they wave the hand.
Right.
Those behaviors are becoming...
But exhaustion and all that, I mean, there's the symptoms and there's the cause.
Okay. And you're saying the cause of burnout is
the learned helplessness. The symptom is the emotional exhaustion, all kinds...
Right.
There's a whole slew of symptoms.
Right, so the internalized...
Feelings of meaninglessness, stress, illnesses, all of these are the symptoms.
So this takes your FUD thing to an extreme.
FUD operates, yes. I use that when I talk about burnout too. Yes.
Okay. So we clear up a couple of these. We went through a little haze there in the middle there, kind of coming out of the bright lights here at the end. Is that if someone is can self-identify as a worrywart, and it probably is going to be contextually, you know, you might worry more about your family than your job or your relationships, whatever. But you might be a worrywart in one of these areas. The way to kind of convert worry wart behavior into smart worry is to reverse some of these trends of the FUD and things like that, so that you don't internalize that and it becomes sort of the way you process and the way you internally represent things to yourself. So you talked about some of the things people can do, and your book goes into detail giving people some strategies. Is it something that lends itself to support group type of stuff, or is this
well, sure,
pretty much...
like one woman I was speaking to recently, she was in her husband is a high powered person who anyway, he was the worrywart, and the rest of the family were always kind of joshing him and saying, you know, they bought him a book to write his worries and he never did, and in my view she was kind of lording over him, like, you know, she didn't worry but he did, so she was somehow superior, and what I suggested to her was no, she should join him in the worry. They could worry together, and if she is actually this more of a smart worrier, he's not going to stop worrying because they're all ganging up on him, because
right.
he's protecting the family with this worry.
Okay.
And the book was a good idea. I suggested, you know, okay, the two of you can sit down, make a place, because it's a good idea to create a place to worry in. And the idea of having a journal to write the worries down, I mean, worry is the control is a big issue in worry. You write the worry down in the journal, you get more of a feeling of control. And then you sit in a place and you deliberately worry. And the first step is actually not trying to do anything, watching yourself worry so that you can learn how you do it, so that you can see yourself doing it. And then you might practice other things like the problem-solving thinking steps of breaking the way you think down and writing these things down in the book and so forth. So, yes, one could do that also in a potential support group. There, a person who could have a support group of people who are worrywarting, and then, see, they're catching each other. I mean, what do support groups do? They teach each other, they catch each other, encourage each other.
And again, this is the mindset because of the safety in numbers concept, is that if we're all concerned about it at the same time, it'll dilute my own concentrated level of doing it on my own. Which is the support group model of recovery and other situations. Sometimes I favor it, sometimes I kick it in the knees a little bit. But
yeah.
When it comes to big fish, like the war, or, you know, they caught the people in Boston today, you know, planning terrorist attacks, and they caught somebody in Denver a couple weeks ago, and of course our friend the swine flu, and the economy and the healthcare stuff, these things that are big, overarching, sort of inescapable, themes or narratives that are going on in the culture right now. How do you smart worry when you deal with
some? I mean, just because a person learns how to worry smart or worry productively doesn't mean that every problem can be solved.
Right, but how do
you know? I'm trying to find that quote. There's a famous quote about help me to. Oh, here it is. God, give us the grace to accept with serenity the things that cannot be changed, the courage to change the things which should be changed and the wisdom to distinguish one from the other. You know, just because a person's worrying smart doesn't mean that it's going to stop the war or it's going to solve the economy or it's going to stop death. I mean, they could be worrying over somebody who's sick in the hospital and, in fact, dies.
No, you talk to those secret people, they think they can, you know, grow hair on a wooden leg someday.
Well,
so, you know.
You know, that's they can do that in a parallel universe, okay?
Oh, good. That's a whole other show, the parallel universe.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there probably is evidence that thinking influences matter, but practically, we can sit here. I mean, that's part of the dilemma of the current time. Is there's severe things out there that are pretty damn scary.
Sure.
And worrisome.
Yeah,
and there's not a lot we can do about it. Or maybe we can come up with a plan. Or maybe we just have to distract ourselves from worrying it. Or maybe we need to turn off the news and not hear it anymore for now.
Well, like I said, I think a lot of this deals with coherence and being able to look at these things, as you said before, in an objective light rather than putting yourself in the horror show and feeling the peril. People go to movie theaters and see horror movies all the time. And they walk out, and they claim they were entertained when they're simulating, you know, life-threatening, perilous things, and that they associate with the characters and things like that. That's why I said before that cinema therapy, that movie in the mind thing, is very popular.
Right. Well, and that's what worry warts, you know, some are doing it with words more, some with images more, but they are creating a horror show, and that's part of the problem. They're scaring themselves to death. But they're doing it in such a way it becomes addictive. But people all the time, we're all the time using all kinds of things to manipulate our moods. Whether it's movies, music, one of the fastest ways to change your mood, faster, it's claimed to be faster than drugs, except maybe, you know, intravenously, but is music. You can change your mood instantaneously with music. You know, a funeral dirge. Or, you know, a love song or an upbeat banjo. And
a
there's
banjo?
Something about music.
How are you talking?
Oh, you're into banjos?
Well, I country music to me is the sort of the, I want to say it's the theme music of the culture, that if you have any problem in your life, there's a country song that could be written and
well,
someone will listen
to it. So we're using all these things all the time
to
modify, but we don't necessarily know what we're doing. I mean, we're not really paying attention. We use foods to change our moods. Hot, spicy foods are stimulating. We can do it on purpose, okay? For example, in ancient history, I used to do training workshops. Well, way before that, I used to be terrified to speak in any kind of group more than one person. So how in the world could I be going around, you know, giving talks to rooms of 1,000 people or, you know, a room of 35 people all day? So when I first started it, I used to deliberately do things to lower my anxiety level. I'd get up an hour earlier than I needed to. And then I would go to a restaurant, you know, like the big country breakfast with the pancakes and all the starch, right? No, that brings you down. The mashed potatoes, if you eat mashed potatoes, you know, and I would fill myself with all this starch, plus I had that extra hour, I'd be sitting there going over my notes, and this is the kind of stuff I would do. But then I became like, I mean, I did it for years. So then it was like, well, I'm not afraid of this. I'm like too tired. You know what I mean? Like I kind of have to stimulate myself to get into just the right zone or whatever you want to call it. And so I would actually sleep later. I skipped the country breakfast. I drank more coffee because I was stimulating myself to be in the better performance because there's a certain optimal level of stress or tension to perform well. Too little, we perform poorly. Too high, we perform poorly. And we can manage ourselves with light, different colored lights. People do this in their apartments all the time. The furniture, the color blue, does totally different things to our minds, and we may not even be noticing as compared to red. We all know this, right?
These are, like I said, these are to me resources of the future, that people will realize that these natural occurring things are much more beneficial than the artificial or the synthetic or the self-medicating behaviors like you're describing here. So
yeah, look at what they do in theaters, okay?
In the theater,
they're creating a whole mood.
Yeah, they do it
with
more
the lights
too.
And the sound and this and that. And we're doing this all the time to ourselves. It's just that, and there's an old technique that you're probably aware of, where you take your, like, the fist of your left hand, and just take your fist and just make your fist as tense. I mean, where you can feel your nails digging into your palms, and you can see your knuckles going white. And you take that fist, and at first it hurts, but if you keep holding your fist like that, with that tension, after about 2 or 3 minutes, you won't even feel it anymore, right? And then if you take your other hand to make a fist, the same degree, you feel the feeling in the one hand and not the other. And this is another one of these paradoxical things about this amazing robot, is that we can be very, very tense and not notice the tension.
Because of the lack of dynamics, if I just basically touch somebody's arm and I don't move my finger at a certain point, there's no perception because there's no variation. And then when people get into a chronic state, like you're saying, that becomes their baseline. That becomes the world,
right,
the atmosphere they live in. And, you know, I think you've given some illustrations of how to be able to notice yourself noticing yourself doing that. And that sort of internal objectivity becomes external when we're able to behave alter our behavior in the sense that we notice ourselves. Like you notice the transition from going in early, eating the carbs, to caffeining up and going in on time. Those are these sort of sluice gates that we're trying to navigate that become, and I hate the word programmable, but they become the way that we can rewire ourselves as we become more self-aware. And that's
right.
One of the things
and it's a matter of that thing with the food or the lights or all these things is the bell-shaped thing and diagram.
Yeah.
We want to keep right there in the middle, and we need to sometimes stimulate ourselves and sometimes and cool ourselves out to keep right in the middle of the optimal performance. That's where we learn best, act best, and most in control. And the important thing is we're doing this all the time. We just don't know how we're doing it. We're not doing it chaotically. We're doing it poorly. We're doing all kinds of stuff to ourselves, but we're still provoking our moods and managing ourselves constantly.
Well, I think
we can just learn. But if we learn how the organism works, we can do it mindfully or purposefully to get a better result.
Well, like I said, I think you've given us a lot to think about here. The book's called The Worrywart's Companion: 21 Ways to Soothe Yourself and Worry Smart. I guess it's been Dr. Beverly Potter. Thanks a lot for spending all this time and straightening us out on a bunch of these things. And hopefully people will listen back and learn to make these distinctions themselves, because it's important to be able to look at some of these words and labels that have been out there in the world and maybe stuck to a couple of our listeners, and they could peel them off and realize that they are active and they are living within those worlds and they can move themselves through them. So thanks for sharing tonight on
okay.
Summertime.
I also want to mention my website, because it's packed with content, quizzes. I mean, not just on the worrywart topic, but there are many articles there.
It's docpotter.com, right?
But there's also the burnout quizzes, and yes, you said it, Doc Potter, and it's DOC, like what's up, Doc?
Right.
And Potter, like Harry Potter. So it's docpotter.com. Tons of information there.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us. Hopefully, some of the listeners will hop over to your site
you
and get the book. And have a good holiday season. Enjoy the rest of Oinktober. And, stay swine-free.
Which holiday season? You mean Halloween?
Well, we got them all lined up now, but I'm just saying we're in the flu season.
We're starting the holiday. That's right.
Yeah. We're in that one.
We need it this year, definitely.
All right, you be well.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. Well, let's see. That was interesting. I need to go on a little journey here. Come on, Bob. Well, not much time left tonight, but sort of a what have we learned kind of a segment here, where we had a little, well, just kind of a little tete-a-tete there with Dr. Potter, you know, and I stuck it out. I stuck it out. That was an Onto Eco turf war. If you're listening at home, somaspace.org. Check out the four domains. We're going to be infusing the summertime hour with a lot more about the four domains. A lot more about being able to profile other people and getting beyond the BS. We barely made it beyond the BS with Dr. Potter there, the belief system. But you know, one of the things we want to get across to you on this show is that certain ideas are much more under the radar and get into your consciousness and can lead to a lot of low coherence behavior. So we're trying to get you out of that mode. And get you to see yourself in a much more systemic and integrated light. So we're going to be going there, okay? So switching gears for a second here, we have a little time left for some Yankee hate. Taking a look at the series that went on, the umps is stinking it up, and the Angels are playing fearful. Maybe they're worry warriors. I don't know. So tomorrow night we got the Onto there, Burkett. Going against Lackey, who is also, well, no, Lackey's actually an XO. So if you don't know what I'm talking about, Onto XO, just go to somaspace.org, click on the four domains, you'll figure out all about it. We talk about brain design on our little site. And as we're watching the Phillies here, with a 6-3 lead here in the bottom of the fifth, I believe, it's been home run derby out there in that little bandbox of a ballpark out there. I just want to get, you know, you passed a little of these, you know, speed bumps we've been talking about the last couple of weeks with the swine flu. And we mentioned before about our friends over there in Cleveland, you know, suffering with it. And Obama did get his seasonal flu shot today. Next week, we're going to be having a guest on that deals with this whole thing from a whole different angle. Drew Oliver from GiantMicrobes.com, who makes little dollies of all these little buggers. So we'll be dealing with that story next week. So, I think I'm going to wind us down here with a little, let's see.
And on really romantic evenings of self, I go salsa dancing with my confusion.
That's right. I'm going to be doing that after this show for sure. I think we're going to go a little Johnny Cash on you here. And, boy, what a day. And play it out that way, and you guys can review the show, and please comment, because I'm doing this for you. I'm doing this to get it out there for you guys, and hopefully get some intelligence across on the airwaves here. So I hope you learned a lot about worry tonight. Be worry-free, be swine-free, be friendly, and always travel light through the darkness.
Well,
see you next week.
My daddy left home when I was 3, and he didn't leave much to Ma and me, just this old guitar and an empty bottle of booze. Now, I don't blame him because he run and hid, but the meanest thing that he ever did was before he left, he went and named me Sue. Well, he must have thought that it was quite a joke, and it got a lot of laughs from lots of folks. Seems I had to fight my whole life through. Some gal would giggle and I'd get red, and some guy'd laugh and I'd bust his head. I'll tell you, life ain't easy for a boy named Sue. Well, I grew up quick and I grew up mean. My fist got hard, my wits got keen. Roamed from town to town to hide my shame. But I made me a vow to the moon and stars, I'd search the honky-tonks and bars and kill that man that gave me that awful name. Well, it was Gatlinburg in mid-July, and I just hit town and my throat was dry. I thought I'd stop and have myself a brew at an old saloon on a street of mud. There at a table, peeling stud, sat the dirty mangy dog that named me Sue. Well, I knew that snake was my own sweet dad from a worn-out picture that my mother'd had. And I knew that scar on his cheek and his evil eye. He was big and bent and gray and old, and I looked at him and my blood ran cold. I said, my name is Sue. How do you do? How you gonna die?
Spread along, Sapiens.